Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today, I offer a potpourri in anticipation of the new year. One meaning of potpourri is a medley of elements. I've been holding on to a medley of recordings, articles, observations, and whatnot that I like but was never able to fit into a show. So we'll toss them in today. Potpourri and medley sound ever so much nicer than a hodgepodge or, worse still, a chimera. We talked about chimera a few shows back. It's an improbable monster composed of incongruous parts. You know, like U.S. foreign policy? Or the late Michael Jackson? Potpourri also implies fragrance. Potpourri's other meaning is a mixture of flowers, herbs, and spices used for scent. The term itself is a bit of a chimera. It's French. Pot means pot, and pourri means rotten. Potpourri literally means rotten pot. Go figure. Ah, this might be a good time to read that article on Gaza. It's by Johan Hari, a highly regarded British journalist, published in The Guardian in April 2008. That's when the State of Israel was celebrating the 60th anniversary of its founding. Gaza is discussed a bit. At the time, Israel had been impoverishing and starving the people of Gaza by blockade and sanctions, but had not yet started dropping Hellfire missiles and white phosphorus bombs on them. That would come 8 months later, beginning the third day of Christmas, December 27, 2008. I've condensed the piece for radio and censored it. Several times, what Serial Mom called the brown word appears, which the FCC strictly prohibits in radio broadcasts. Like most FCC rulings, this is another big crock of potpourri. But there you have it. Johan Hari's article is titled, Israel is suppressing a secret it must face. Israel is celebrating her 60th birthday, yet somewhere she will know she's suppressing an old secret that she has to face. I would love to crash the birthday party with words of reassurance. Like, Israel has provided the one lonely spot in the Middle East where gay people are not hounded and hanged, and where women can approach equality. But I can't do it. Whenever I try to mouth these words, a remembered smell fills my nostrils. It is the smell of human excrement. Across the occupied West Bank, raw, untreated sewage is pumped every day out of the Jewish settlements straight onto Palestinian land. From there, it can enter the groundwater and the reservoirs and become a poison. Standing near one of these long, stinking, brown and yellow rivers of waste recently, the local chief medical officer, Dr. Bassam Saeed Nadi, explained to me, quote, recently there were very heavy rains, and the excrement started to flow into the reservoir that provides water for this whole area. I knew that if we didn't act, people would die. We had to alert everyone not to drink the water for over a week and distribute bottles. We were lucky it was spotted. Next time, unquote. He shook his head in fear. This is no freak. A 2004 report by Friends of the Earth found that only 6% of Israeli settlements adequately treated their sewage. Not 60%, 6%. Sidebar comment. Then in 2005, Israel required its settlers to leave Gaza. The settlers left their excrement behind, however. Back to the text. Meanwhile, in order to punish the population of Gaza for voting the wrong way in January 2006, the Israeli army are not allowing past the checkpoints the replacement pipes and cement needed to keep the sewage system working. The result? Vast, stagnant pools of waste are being held within fragile dikes across the Gaza Strip and rotting. Last March, one dike burst, drowning a 9-month-old baby and his elderly grandmother in a tsunami of human waste. The Center on Housing Rights warns that one heavy rainfall could send 1.5 million cubic meters of feces flowing all over Gaza, causing, quote, a humanitarian and environmental disaster of epic proportions, unquote. So how did a Jewish state founded 60 years ago with a promise to be a light unto the nations end up flinging its filth at a cowering Palestinian population? The beginnings of an answer lie in the secret Israel has known and suppressed all these years. Even now, can we describe what happened 60 years ago honestly? The Jews who arrived in Palestine in the early 20th century did not come because they were cruel people. They did not come because they wanted to persecute Arabs. No, they came because they were running for their lives from a genocidal European anti-Semitism that was soon to slaughter 6 million of their sisters and their sons. They convinced themselves that Palestine was, quote, a land without people for a people without land, unquote. But most of Palestine was not empty. It was already inhabited by people who loved the land and saw it as theirs. And these people were completely innocent of the long, hellish crimes against the Jews. Dark plans were drawn up. The man who would become Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, wrote in 1937, "The Arabs will have to go, but one needs an opportune moment for making it happen, such as a war." So, for when the moment arrived, he helped draw up Plan Dalit. It was, as Israeli historian Ilan Papi put it, quote, "a detailed description of the methods to be used to forcibly evict the people, large-scale intimidation, and laying siege to and bombarding population centers," unquote. In 1948, before the Arab armies invaded, this began to be implemented. Some 800,000 people were ethnically cleansed, and Israel was built on the ruins. Not surprisingly, the Palestinians kept longing for their old land. The Israelis say, if we let all 3 million refugees come back to the state of Israel, we will be outnumbered by the Palestinians. They could vote Israel out of existence. But in 2006, a Palestinian NGO conducted the first study of the Palestinian diaspora's desires. They found that only 10% wanted to return to Israel proper. That's only 300,000, not 3 million. Israel can accept that many and compensate the rest without even enduring much pain. But there has always been a part of Israeli society that prefers violently setting its own borders on its own terms to talk and compromise. This weekend, in April 2008, the occupied territories elected Hamas government offered a 6-month truce that could have led to talks. The Israeli government responded within hours by blowing up a senior Hamas leader and killing a 14-year-old girl. Perhaps Hamas's proposals are a con. Perhaps the Arab states are lying, too, when they offer Israel full recognition in exchange for a rollback to the 1967 borders. But isn't it a good idea to find out? Israel, as she gazes at her gray hairs and discreetly ignores the smell of her own stale excrement pumped across Palestine, needs to ask what kind of country she wants to be in the next 60 years. Now a footnote by me. As noted, only 8 months after Hari wrote this, on December 27, 2008, Israel answered the question of what kind of country it wants to be. Ilan Papi's summary of Plan Dalit, drawn up by Ben-Gurion and other terrorists 10 years before the State of Israel even existed and followed to this day. Forcibly evict the Palestinians from Palestine through large-scale intimidation and laying siege to and bombarding population centers. Let me be clear here. I have nothing against the people of Israel, but the ruling elite that controls their government has committed despicable crimes against humanity and justified everyone by pretending it was in self-defense. And the same is true in spades for my own country. Like probably most Americans, I consider myself an American friend of Israel. Well, friends don't let friends drive drunk. Friends don't let friends commit war crimes, crimes of occupation, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and plain, old-fashioned bloody murder. And if such outrages are perpetrated, friends don't look the other way, defend the indefensible, and rename genocide as self-defense. The same goes for my own country. Since 2003, the government of the United States has killed, impoverished, and displaced more Iraqis than the Israelis have done to Palestinians since Israel was founded. It's close, admittedly, but I think we're still ahead. In the last year or two of the Vietnam War, the United States Air Force dropped more tonnage of bombs on the little country of Cambodia than were dropped everywhere by all sides during World War II. That's including Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We weren't even at war with Cambodia, and Congress had never authorized any military action in that country. How many millions of people do you have to kill before people start giving you disapproving looks? Now, suppose you were quarreling with your neighbor. If you take a baseball bat and smash the skull of your neighbor's pet Pekingese, or even just put a nice dent in the rear side panel of her car, several officials of your government will soon get in touch with you and make you clearly understand that the government does not approve of your resolving disputes through force and violence. And if you're just an average Joe, you're going to be punished for your crime. I guess the moral of the story is pretty clear. If you're going to kill, kill big. Here's a song by Bruce Cockburn. He wrote it in 1983. It's not about Palestine, and the bad guys are not the Israelis, but the reactionary death squads in Guatemala. There's no connection. There's no similarity. You can't compare these two periods of state-sponsored terrorism. Well, maybe one small similarity. A third country that in both cases paid for every bullet, every cluster bomb, every assault helicopter. The country that paid the bill for the carnage. Your tax dollars at work. Here's Bruce Cockburn.
stop to try. Every time I think about it, water rises to my eyes. Situation desperate, echoes of the victim's cry. If I had a rocket launcher, if I had a rocket launcher, if I had a rocket launcher, some son of a bitch would die.
I'm not broadcasting all this because I hate my country. I love my country. After World War II, we told the ruling elite and also the citizens of Germany, without mincing words, that the first step to preventing another horrific global bloodbath is for them to recognize, confess to, and make some small amends for the misery they had inflicted on Europe. And I believe the Germans have done a better job than most nations of recognizing, confessing, and atoning. Today we heard Johann Hari's words, noting that it's time the State of Israel did the same. And by now you're surely tired of hearing me say the same of the United States. You wouldn't know it from listening to Fox News, but what I'm saying is neither new nor original. Millions of Americans have been saying the same for centuries. Thoreau said it in the early 19th century. Mark Twain said it at the end of the 19th century. In that case, about our government's bloody rampage in the Philippines. Millions have said it throughout the 20th century and are still saying it. Like Emile Zola, sometimes we feel we just have to stand up, point our index or other finger at the government, and exclaim, "I accuse! I accuse!" I imagine this might help a little. Go ahead, call me a cockeyed optimist, immature and incredibly green. I could say life is just a bowl of jello and appear more intelligent and smart, but I'm stuck like a dope with a thing called hope, and I can't get it out of my heart. So sue me. Hey, this show hasn't been much of a potpourri, has it? I mean, all the elements of the show have been as closely connected as in any other episode. All right, let me try again. Here's Glenn Ford, editor of Black Agenda Report. Just as you don't have to be Jewish to love Levy's rye bread, you don't have to be black to love Black Agenda Report. www.blackagendareport.com. I'm reminded of another piece of poetry besides the Levy's bread ad, the end of John Donne's famous sonnet, which goes, "Send not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." It's not "ask not," incidentally. It's "send not for whom the bell tolls." Obviously, you dispatch a spare household servant to run out and ask who died. You wouldn't bother to go yourself. So send not for whom Glenn Ford speaks. He speaks for thee.
How does one restore the lords of capital to their former positions as dictators of the U.S. and global economies while keeping their seats warm as the de facto political rulers of the American state? Saving the finance capital oligarchy has emerged as President Obama's central mission, the guiding focus of his young administration. Obama has found new and myriad ways to go where no American president has ever gone before, in funneling somewhere around $13 trillion of the national treasure to the parasitical class that goes by the shorthand Wall Street. By March of this year, the federal government and the Federal Reserve had spent, lent, or committed $12.8 trillion to the banksters, according to the Bloomberg Financial Service. That amounts to 90% of the gross domestic product of the entire United States economy for last year. Let us put it another way. Mostly under the auspices of Barack Obama's administration, the value of nearly every good and service produced in the United States in 2008 has been, in one way or another, put at the disposal of a tiny financial oligarchy. This is the kind of overarching reality that defines not just presidencies, but eras. In the cold assessment of history, Barack Obama will be remembered more for his massive transfers of national wealth to the finance capitalist class than as the first black president of the United States. The primary beneficiaries of this history-shaking generosity are the same banksters that brought about the economic meltdown through their monstrous invention, the derivative. This fictitious capital, derivatives, created to facilitate gambling on a scale that far exceeds the productive capacity of the entire planet Earth, is a cancer that Barack Obama has chosen to feed rather than cut out. As F. William Engdahl points out in a recent article, 5 U.S. banks are the biggest repositories of toxic derivatives: J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, and Wells Fargo Wachovia Bank. Together, these 5 banksters of the apocalypse hold derivatives with the notional value of $193 trillion. That is more than 3 times the value of the real economy of the whole world, which is about $60 trillion. These deadly derivatives continue to sit there, immovable, in these 5 fatally stricken institutions. There are not enough trillions existent in the national or world economies to absorb these fatal instruments. There is nothing rational to do but to wipe out the obligations and their holders off the face of the earth in order to save the real economy. Instead of feeding the cancer, a rational government would use the people's wealth to create public institutions to dispense credit and guide economic development. The bankster gamblers would be consigned to the dustbin of history and good riddance. But President Obama has chosen to use the limited resources of the current and future United States, $13 trillion so far, to prop up a criminal class. All the manufactured hoopla about stock market rallies and phony stress tests is intended to mask the central truth of our time. The derivatives cancer will eat away at the real economy until the class that spawned it is cut away and flushed out of existence. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
I was managing my assets late one night when my eyes beheld a dreadful sight. The economy began to destabilize, and suddenly, to my surprise,
the market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
A monster crash.
No one could borrow cash.
The market crashed.
It collapsed in a flash.
The market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
From the corner office and executive suite to the trading floor and throughout Wall Street, everybody came from their humble abodes to salvage what they could while the system implodes.
The market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
A monster crash.
No one could borrow cash.
The market crashed.
It collapsed in a flash.
The market crashed.
It was a monster crash.
Wall Street was having fun. The party had just begun. The guests included Greenspan, Bernanke, and Paul Sun.
The scene was rocking or were digging the sounds of the bailout bills that were making the rounds. From Congress, relief was about to arrive. $700 billion to keep us alive.
We got some cash.
We got some monster cash.
Some monster cash.
It was a Wall Street smash.
We got some cash.
It arrived in a flash.
We got some cash.
We got some monster cash.
Out of the coffin, a voice did ring. Someone was troubled by this whole thing. We opened the lid to see who was there. He said, whatever happened to laissez-faire?
It's turned to mash.
It's turned to monster mash.
Out with the trash.
There was a strong backlash.
It's turned to mash.
Wall Street was much too rash.
It's turned to mash.
It's turned to monster mash.
Now everything is cool, it has gone as planned, and the bailout bill is the law of the land. In a few more years, we'll forget, and then unregulated markets will be back again.
Then we can mash.
And we can lend out cash.
The monster mash.
Sometimes we'll be a smash.
Then we can mash.
We'll get rich in a flash.
Then we can mash.
We'll lend out lots of cash.
Wah-moo. Merrill Lynch, wah-moo. Freddie Mac, wah-moo. AIG, wah-moo.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Remember, you can get anything you want, Sepinellis, at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. The opinions expressed here are needless to say. This installment was recorded at WWUH's spacious above ground east of the river satellite studio and skunk works in Manchester, Connecticut. In this region, east of the river is a euphemism for the boondocks. Illegitimi non carborundum, from each to each, and from my home east of the river to yours, Happy New Year.
But is it in your conscience that you're after? Now the glance of a man.